This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. Emily Gunn is producing today, and your numbers are 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, outside this area. You can call us toll-free at 877-217-5757, and you can email us at any time at talk@talklouisiana.org. It was 30 years ago today, on the 24th of October, 1987, that one of the most memorable gubernatorial races in Louisiana history was held. The primary included five luminaries at the time and three sitting congressmen, Buddy Romer, Bob Livingston, Billy Tozan, the incumbent governor, Edwin Washington Edwards, and the Secretary of State, Jim Brown. Edwin Edwards is going to join us in just a moment, but it was his only electoral defeat as a gubernatorial candidate. He won the four other times he ran for office, an unprecedented record of success in Louisiana politics. But here's how it sounded in the early morning hours of October 25th. After a tough night for Edwin Edwards, he finished second in the primary to Buddy Romer with 28% of the votes. Romer received 33%. And here was Edwin Edwards at about 2 o'clock in the morning at the Monteleone Hotel.
Under the circumstances, since I did not run first, that it would be inappropriate for me to continue this election. Please hear me out. I have to do what I think is best for my state. I don't want it further divided. There's never been a time in modern history when the combined efforts of the media has been so bent and dedicated on taking over the governor's office.
That was Edwin Washington Edwards 30 years ago tonight, and he is with us. He was 60 then, he's 90 now, just as spry as he was 30 years ago. And good morning to you, Governor Edwards.
Good morning. Happy to be with you.
Do you recall that evening?
Oh, very well. It was one of the best, smartest things I ever did.
It set the stage for 1991. It enabled.
That's correct.
Did you know that at the time?
Oh, I could see it. Here's the thing. Buddy Romer had conned the publishers in Louisiana into believing that he was against gambling and could do all these wonderful things in government, which I knew he didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And so when it happened the way it did, I decided, well, I'll give him a chance to prove me wrong. And, of course, he did not, because 6 months after he was governor, he was very unpopular. Now, while he was governor, this anti-gambling fellow who had conned these newspapers into believing he'd be against gambling, riverboat gambling was passed, video poker was passed, character banging was passed, and a lottery was passed. Every form of gambling except the casino in New Orleans was passed while Buddy Romer was governor, who had campaigned falsely on an issue of being against gambling. And I told the people that night, you'll know in a few months exactly what I'm talking about. He doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
Do you stay in touch with him?
I see him every now and then.
Well, he was on this show not long ago, and we know he has suffered a stroke, so his speech is impaired, which, of course, was his greatest gift. His oratorical skills were legendary, like yours. But here's what he said a few weeks ago on this program, Governor, about that night and that election.
I couldn't believe it. He took away from me what I wanted. That was to battle him throughout the state, slay the dragon. And he quit. That amazed me.
Now, you made a very calculated decision. When did you make the decision? Was it in your room at the Monteleone?
Yes, I made the decision when I realized that people had been conned by the press into believing that Buddy Romer was going to stop gambling in Louisiana and restore all of it. The state was suffering financially because of the decline in oil and gas prices. We had lost 250,000 jobs and we had problems. Buddy Romer never balanced the budget. When he left office, it was $600 million in debt.
Well, he had a fiscal reform plan that he touted and presented to the voters in 1989. In fact, one of the masterminds was his close aide, John Kennedy, who's now a U.S. senator. That failed, and many believe that was the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back, that he never recovered from that.
Well, it failed because it was stupid. It was totally impractical and had no possibility of passing. And he lost control of the legislature because he was not responsive to them. Let me tell you something. In the history of our state, while he was governor, his hand-picked president of the Senate was dethroned by the Senate, and one of my best friends was elected in his place. That's unheard of in Louisiana politics.
I remember when Alan Barrez was sent out the door and Sammy Nunez was returned to the Senate presidency. Governor, right. I must say, after all these years, you still sound upset about what happened.
I'm upset because he had convinced the publishers in this state to do something which I thought was improper. They took a position in the election to help him get elected without knowing what he could do. And I tried to tell them, look, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And I said, look, okay, you didn't take my advice. I'll give you a chance to prove me wrong. And I was proved right because he was an utter failure. When he ran for re-election, he couldn't even get more votes than David Duke.
No, he finished third, and he's right. well aware of that. Third behind you and Duke and Romer, and then you smashed David Duke. But I think it's fair to say he also would have defeated David Duke in a runoff.
Well, probably so. I mean, even Buddy Romer would have beat David Duke in a runoff.
Well, in 87, if you had been in a runoff with Bob Livingston, who finished third, would you have defeated him?
Oh, absolutely. That's what I tried to do. During the whole campaign, I did everything I could to shore him up. Bob Livingston was sitting in the forums, and he didn't even know the answers to questions. He didn't even remember the questions one time. And I tried to help him out, but he thought I was trying to hurt him, so he didn't pay attention to me. But I wanted Bob Livingston in the runoff because he was the guy that I could beat.
Well, he was the Republican, and in that race...
Right.
In that race, there were five major candidates, but on the whole, there was 8 candidates, and 7 were Democrats. We have a reversal now. What's happened in our state to the point now that if we had a race like this today, you'd probably have 7 Republicans and 1 Democrat.
Probably so, and it's just an unfortunate situation, but the Democratic Party has lost faith in Louisiana. And I think people have become disillusioned with it. And it's responsible to a number of things. Number one, the economy. Number two, the national politics has gone all red and Republican. And Louisiana has followed that trend. And number three, and I've said this before, reapportionment has created the problem. When they started reapportioning districts to favor parties rather than people, it ended up with districts that were totally Republican, and it, when it did that, it created a district that was totally Democrat, and we ended up with a legislature that's Republican and a Congress that's Republican.
Now, a listener asks, how scarred were you by the two trials in 85 and 86 when you ran for re-election in 1987?
Well, it certainly didn't help, but not so much the trials, but the fact that the trials took me away from my job for about 6 months. And during that time, I was not able to fully serve in my capacity as governor, although I ran the office from the courthouse and did whatever I could. But it was certainly not a very good thing for me, and I suffered for it, and I think the state suffered for it.
Governor, you've been blessed with a great mind that is still going strong at 90, robust health, fantastic career that is unparalleled in Louisiana, but it's apparent you still keep score. I can tell right now that those old competitive juices are flowing as though it were October 24th in 1987 right now.
Oh, yes, I've never lost. So every day, believe me, every day I do something to help people. Because many people can't find anybody to help them. They can't talk to anybody. They can't contact anybody. And it's difficult to even get people on the phone now.
What do you say to those who say that you were in it for yourself?
Well, if so, I didn't do a very good job.
Well, your legacy is going to be immense. Go ahead.
I'm 90 years old and struggling to make a living. And let me tell you, with all that has been said about me by hostile press and hostile federal prosecutors, I have never been charged with wrongdoing as a governor, period. I was never been charged with taking anything from the taxpayers. It all happened after I was governor.
Well, Governor, it is always a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for joining us on a day I'm sure that you'd rather forget 30 years ago, but it is great to get your insights as always. We appreciate your time.
I don't want to forget the past. I want to profit from it, and I repeat again, if I had stayed in the runoff with Jim Brown, who was Secretary of State, and Billy Tozan, member of Congress, would have supported me, and I'd have probably beat Roma, but that's academic.
Thank you, Governor. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. The heralded columnist for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune, Bob Mann, is with us. Also a professor of mass communications at Louisiana State University and the author of several well-received books. And in recent columns through the last few years, Bob has not been kind in his assessment of our previous guest, Edwin Washington Edwards, who on this night in October of 1987, October 24th, lost his only bid for governor in five tries. His Buddy Romer got 33% that night. Edwin Edwards received 28%. The actual votes were 516,128 to 434,802. And to put that in perspective, in a primary in 1983, Edwin Edwards received well over 1 million votes against David Treen, an incumbent governor. So his popularity had eroded quite a bit. There were three other luminaries in that race. Bob Livingston finished third, Billy Tozan fourth, Jim Brown fifth, and Speedy Long, the former congressman, finished sixth. Bob, do you recall where you were 30 years ago tonight?
Yeah, I do. I was in Leesville, Louisiana, where I went to high school, and it was my 10th high school reunion that night. So I was there, sort of watching the returns with one eye and trying to enjoy the festivities with the other, and it was quite a night.
What did you make of the results?
I think by the time that Election Day came along, we saw Romer surging. I think the real story was of that race was not just how Romer won the race and not just how Edwin Edwards dropped out of the race to give Romer that win on election night, but how Romer came from really back in the pack, not considered for the longest time in that race a real factor, or at least someone who had a real chance of getting into the race. He saved his money till the end, made a very strong argument for his candidacy, played his cards right almost every turn, and surged into the lead at the end. And that was, it was, even if Edwin had not dropped out on that night, it still would have been a stunning story, Romer's meteoric rise mm-hmm. in those last few weeks.
Well, and Edwin Edwards acknowledges that Romer would have defeated him handily in a runoff, and that's why he dropped out. But he also said that Romer benefited enormously from newspaper endorsements. I recall the Sunday Picayune front page endorsement of Buddy Romer, which was a stunner, and it kind of set the stage for his rise from fifth to first in a matter of a few weeks.
Yeah, it really did. The stars just really all aligned to help Romer. Everything worked out for him at the end, and he really did become the. And this is a tribute to him. It wasn't. I think the newspapers and others were responding to his message, but Romer really, I think, set himself up as the most vociferous opponent of Edwin Edwards and everything that he stood for. I mean, we all, those of us who were around in those days, remember the slogans that are still fairly familiar: "Slay the Dragon," "Scrub the Budget," "Brick up the top mm-hmm. three floors of the education building." These were really evocative sayings that I think captured the imagination of a lot of people who were tired of what Edwin Edwards had done in the previous 4 years.
Now, Romer is now 74 years old. He had a stroke a couple of years ago, and his speech is impaired. But he was on this show a few weeks ago, and we saved these remarks for today. And here he is once again commenting about what happened on this night in 1987 and how Edwin Edwards threw in the towel, which ultimately was the catalyst for an Edwards comeback 4 years later.
It was about Edwards. I made the point that my job was to beat Edwards. If I won, so be it. But even if I didn't win, my job was to slay the dragon. And the campaign took off from there.
So he used that slay the dragon at the Baton Rouge Press Club when he was asked, would he endorse Edwin Edwards if he were in a runoff with Bob Livingston or one of the other candidates? And he said no. He said he would endorse anybody against Edwards, and that also was a catalyst for his success. But why was he a one-term governor, Bob Mann?
Well, I think he's like Buddy Romer was like a lot of reformers in this state who maybe were a bit of ahead of their time. You know, reform is really hard in this state. The forces are strong and allied against anyone who wants to change the status quo. The corporate interests and all of that are really in control down at the Capitol in ways that oftentimes the governor cannot overcome. But I also think that I think Romer to some extent would argue that the people around him would admit that they weren't always politically smart, that they moved too fast, they didn't listen, they didn't build alliances in the legislature. It was more this attitude, I think, of when people in the legislature would suggest, well, hey, here's maybe how we can get this done, the response was often, in essence, thanks, but we'll do it our way. Mm-hmm. And they made a lot of enemies when they needed friends, and they got taught a lesson on a number of occasions during those 4 years.
And Governor Romer also switched parties in the middle of his term, anticipating that he would have the right flank to himself against Edwin Edwards, and then along came David Duke.
Yeah, that was a miscalculation. I don't know if he had a chance of, I don't know if it would have been any better if he'd stayed a Democrat, but that party switch did not help him like he thought it would. Mm-hmm. He, as you point out, he didn't account for David Duke coming in to his far right and just cutting him off at the knees there.
Well, that race had four major Democrats who were three sitting congressmen and the Secretary of State and the governor. The one congressman who was a Republican, Bob Livingston, was the only GOP candidate in the field. We commented with Governor Edwards, you would not see a field like that today for governor, Bob.
No, it's funny you say that. I was reviewing the outcome of that primary, and I noticed that everyone but Livingston reminded me that everyone but Livingston was a Democrat, and it really was kind of an arresting sight to look at Edwards, Dem, Romer, Democrat, Tozan, Democrat, Jim Brown, Democrat, Speedy Long, Democrat, one Republican in there, Bob Livingston, and it would be just pretty much the opposite in today's environment.
And there was more participation in those days. Jim Brown got 138,000 votes, and that was 9%. A few weeks ago, John Schroeder got 96,000 votes, and he got essentially elected treasurer with 96,000 votes in a state with 4.7 million people. Now, Jim Brown was a popular Secretary of State, and at times in that campaign, he was running second or third. He dropped as Romer rose, and he ran a memorable spot. Now, this one is, we found it, I think, the first rap song ever for a campaign candidate. This was Jim Brown in 1987 through the voice of Jules Democourt.
Two eyes to see what's true. Two ears to hear it too. Two feet and two hands. Now let's see where you stand. Got two hands, but only takes one to vote two. Be sure we've won. Take 2 feet to the polls. Here's how it goes. Black is beautiful. Brown is two. Now, brother, sister, it's up to you. Jim, Jim, vote two for Jim. Brown, Brown, all around town. Black is beautiful. Brown is two. It's up to you. Jim Brown, number two. The man, you with the plan.
Perhaps that's why he finished fifth, Bob.
I don't remember. You know, I may have heard that, but I don't remember that one. I can't. If I had heard it, I can't believe I would have forgotten it. So maybe the first time I ever heard that. That's pretty wild.
And he also had a spot at the end the last week in which he said, "Whatever you do, don't vote for Buddy Romer." And
yeah, that's right. Remember that.
Didn't work out well. Well, we're going to talk with Bob Mann about the 45th American president. We're in day 278 of the presidency of Donald John Trump. Your number, 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633, and email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Now the news with Karen Henderson on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Bob Mann is with us, professor at the Manship School of Mass Communication at LSU, and also a columnist of note with NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. 877-217-5757 is your number. Bob, in his latest column, writes, families don't usually fall apart suddenly. One day a husband and wife are inseparable. 2 years later, they realize they become strangers after their relationship gradually fell victim to 100 minor offenses and omissions. Societies also fray and fail in incremental ways, like a pot on the stove with a proverbial frog in it. The temperature of societal change inches up. It's too late to escape when we reach the boiling point. Perhaps boiling frogs and dissolving families are apt metaphors for what is happening to this country under Donald Trump. It feels we are slowly forsaking values we once treasured and guarded. That's how Bob started his latest column. Why do you think he's a danger, our 45th American president, Bob?
Well, you know, I wish I had thought of this analogy before I wrote the column. I would have put this in here, too. I was walking the other day just at the UREC here at the LSU campus, listening to a podcast on my iPhone, and it suddenly occurred to me that this amazing device that allows me to do all these amazing, incredible, revolutionary things, I just take it for granted. You know, everybody who has an iPhone had it for about 3 days and marveled at it and thought it's the most amazing, revolutionary device they'd ever seen. And then they went on about their lives and regarded it, as they do now, as a perfectly normal thing that they should have in their lives. They can't imagine living without it, but it doesn't seem revolutionary anymore. And I think that Trump is like a bit like an iPhone, that we quickly accommodate to his corruption and to his obscene way of operating. And it doesn't take long for stuff that last year was outrageous and scandalous to become just the normal way of doing business. And I think it's really, really dangerous for us to, and it's really hard to stay outraged about. You know, you can't be outraged about everything every day. And after a while, I think we've become numb to some of this stuff, and we're going to start accepting it in ways that I think in, you know, a year or two or three or five or 10, we're going to look back and say, what were we thinking? How did this happen? Well, it happens gradually. And one day you look up and, you know, some of your freedoms are gone.
Well, will this spawn other candidates and office holders like him?
I think it will. I think his success breeds success. And I think there are a certain type of people who are going to be, who would not have been tolerated in American politics before, who will look at Trump and will say, well, if he can do it, I can. And you know, the bar has been lowered to the point that, you know, that I can, you know, I can do these things. And if the president can say this stuff, then, you know, a candidate for the U.S. Senate or a mayor or whatever can also say this stuff. And I think you're going to see, look, Bob Corker today, the senator from Tennessee, was asked in a hallway interview, do you think that Donald Trump is a role model to children? This is a Republican senator, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, said, absolutely not. The debasement of our nation is what he'll be remembered for. And that is, I think that's true. And Republicans are recognizing it just like Democrats are.
Well, the Republicans who are speaking out are those who are not running again, Bob Corker and John McCain, and most notably. Why aren't Republican current office holders speaking out?
Well, some of them are. Ben Sasse from Nebraska, Jeff Flake from Arizona. There are some examples of principled Republicans who have challenged Trump and very forcefully. But you're right; most of them have not. And I think it's because most of them are in very very blue districts that that vote 70-80% Republican, and they're afraid of being primaried, and they're afraid that if they speak out, that that the Trump supporters in their districts or their states will rise up and vote for someone to their right, just like we were talking about Buddy Romer getting David Duke to his right, and it did him in, and they see that happening to them if they speak out against Trump. So they're afraid of being defeated for re-election in these very conservative states.
But in Louisiana, we have an open primary, and it's a bit different, maybe a lot different. We have five Republican congressmen and two Republican U.S. senators, and I don't know of an unkind word that any of them have said publicly about President Trump.
Yeah, there's a I've seen in the last few days some commentary about how states need to move to more open primaries. We need to do away with the party primaries. That if we do that, that it'll make the politics of that state more moderate and create more room for moderates to run and win. And Louisiana is not any proof of that from our recent politics.
And in Louisiana, Bob, when we look at the Democratic Party, we have a Democratic governor in our state, but the Democrats didn't even field a candidate they could support for treasurer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think they're going to probably get behind Edwards now, but yeah, you're right. They kind of abandoned him and ignored him. And there's a very a short bench on the Democratic side, and they're going to have to do a better job of developing their talent. I think in this state and other states, politics can turn quickly and fortunes can change, but they're not going to change for the Democratic Party if the party's not developing its bench and bringing young talent along.
And in this race, there was an opportunity probably for a moderate Democrat, but there aren't many of those out there.
Well, yeah, they are out there, but I think that a lot of them don't see it's just, you can, where you want to spend the next 6 months of your life and a lot of your money and quit your business or whatever to run for an office that you maybe have a 10% chance of winning. It's just, it's just not the kind of environment that's very hospitable to even moderate Democrats.
Now, a listener notes, and it's a good observation, that if, let's say, if State Representative Gene Reynolds of Minden had run for treasurer, he is a Democrat, he might have won.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that much about him, but yeah, I think obviously
he's a moderate Democrat.
A moderate Democrat is going to have a better chance. And look, frankly, let's just put our cards on the table here. A white Democrat is going to have a better chance in this state. I mean, I don't think this is a state that's ready to elect an African American of any party to statewide office. It's just not probably going to happen anytime soon, which is a shame. But it's just a fact of life here.
Which makes Kip Holden's finish a few years ago in the lieutenant governor's race. He got 45% against Billy Nungesser. It makes it a notable.
Yeah, he did better than I think anybody has, right?
Any African American, yeah.
That was notable because he ran a terrible campaign, not really much of a campaign, and he still did pretty well.
Yeah, he got 45% against Billy Nungesser, and now Billy Nungesser is one of the few Republicans not slamming John Bel Edwards on a regular basis. Our governor is going to have a challenge for re-election. Do you think he's up to that challenge?
Well, I do. I think that he's about as well-positioned as he could possibly be as a Democrat. I think his popularity is still pretty high, amazingly high, really. No scandals. His Achilles heel is going to be this budget, and what it's going to take to keep us from going over this fiscal cliff in the next fiscal year. And if things go really wrong, I mean, look, we were just talking about Edwin Edwards. One of the things that killed Edwin Edwards in the mid-'80s was that he had to raise taxes. And then when he couldn't raise taxes enough, and the economy kept going down, he had to cut and cut and cut to balance the budget. And those kind of environments are just not conducive to being reelected as governor. It's a lot easier to get reelected when times are good and the money's flowing and all that. The revenue situation in the state is stabilized, but we've still got this fiscal cliff that we've got to keep from plunging over. And whatever happens with that, I think, is going to have a lot of say about whether he can run for reelection successfully.
Mm-hmm. Well, Edwin Edwards is the last Democrat to win consecutive terms as Louisiana governor. That was 1975, Bob. So by the time we get to 2019, we're 34 years, 1975 to, that's 25 plus 44 years. 44 years removed from the last Democrat to win two straight terms. That's why I think many say, look, John Bel Edwards is going to have a tough battle.
Oh, look, if you're a Democrat in the state running or running for reelection, you're sailing into headwinds. You don't have the wind behind you. It can be done, but it's a lot harder. It's just going to be a lot harder.
And we saw that with your former boss, Kathleen Blanco. She opted not to run for reelection.
Yeah, she did. Now, I don't think there's any chance that Edwards doesn't run for reelection.
Oh, he's running. He's running.
Yeah, and look, here's the other thing that I think he's got going for him. Like Bobby Jindal, when he ran for his second term, he amassed such a war chest that he knocked out a lot of opposition and made it a lot harder for people to decide whether to get in that race because Jindal was so well-funded. I think Edwards is going to have as much or more as Jindal had when he was running for reelection, and he's going to be able to make his case. He's going to be able to be on TV probably as long as he wants to, making the case for his reelection, and that's not to be dismissed lightly.
877-217-5757 is your number. We're going to spend another segment with Bob Mann, professor at the Manship School of Mass Communications and also an accomplished writer. We'll even get his take on the Vietnam series from Ken Burns. Bob wrote one of the best books about Vietnam, Grand Delusion, which when you look at it now, it certainly was a predecessor that I suspect Ken Burns was influenced by. But we also are going to reflect some more on President Trump, and it looks like Governor John Bel Edwards may have a major opponent who is ramping up to run for governor, a guy we're familiar with, John Neely Kennedy. He just was elected to the U.S. Senate last year and gives every indication that he will be on the ballot 2 years from today. Actually, the election is, I think, October 21st of 2019, so we're inside 2 years. 877-217-5757 is your number, 297-5633 locally, and we're back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Emily Gunn is producing. Robert Townley Mann Jr. is with us. He is the Douglas Manship Chair of Journalism at Louisiana State University and a columnist with NOLA.com and with the Times-Picayune. 877-217-5757 is your number, and talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. And before we talk about John Neely Kennedy, and we do have one email on him as well. Here's one from Steve Wenham, former budget director, saying, I never realized the similarities between Edwin Edwards and Donald Trump until EWE's interview on this show this morning. What does Bob think of that comparison? Bob?
I guess there's, in some ways you could maybe compare the two of them. As communicators, I think I would side with Edwin being so much more effective Edwin would attack you, but he would do it in a clever way. He would insult you, and you weren't really sure you'd been insulted maybe sometimes, or you almost had to laugh. He was much more deft. Trump is more, comes at you with a baseball bat. And I think Edwin at least made people enjoy there was a sort of a spirit of joy in Edwin campaigning that you don't find in Trump.
And he was so quick, and still is. He is an amazing force of nature. But I recall in 1983 when he was running against David Treen in a debate, Governor Treen asked Edwards, "Why do you speak out of both sides of your mouth?" And he said, "Because people, so people with half a brain like you can understand me."
Yeah, he was quick. He was so quick. And you're right. You know, the times I've seen him speak or been around him in the last few years, just amazing that he has not lost a, he doesn't seem to have lost a step in the quickness of his mind. It's pretty remarkable.
And when he was acquitted in 1986 in his bribery trial in New Orleans, a national reporter was the first one to ask a question of him. He said, "Governor Edwards, what do you say to those who say you're guilty as hell, the feds just weren't smart enough to catch you?" And he said, "They're half right."
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, that, you know, I always marveled at how quickly his mind processed and was able to spit out those quips. It's you know, and it makes you just think about the brilliance of this man, and what a shame it was that that brilliance didn't always go toward the best interest of the state.
Now, the current governor, John Bel Edwards, is an admirer of Edwin Washington Edwards. He's made no mistake, hasn't tried to hide that, but he's not tried to emulate him because you can't duplicate the original. But John Kennedy of late has been throwing out these one-liners about weed killer and keeping the mini bar keys from Lindsay Lohan, and sometimes he puts his foot in his mouth. But he looks like he's the guy who's going to be running against Governor Edwards in 2 years. What do you make of that potential race?
You know, it's kind of head scratching because I first started hearing about Kennedy's desire to run for governor back in April when he had literally been in Washington less than 4 months. Having been sworn in early January. I mean, this was not something that I think a lot of people saw. I mean, I think they, you know, we know that Kennedy wants to be governor. He's wanted to be governor for a long time. He's run for governor before, but and tried to be shadow governor during Jindal's last term. But you know, when you run for the Senate, you don't expect the guy to just to get up there and start using the position to start running for another office on the day he arrives, and that's what Kennedy has done. It's an unusual strategy, but as you say, Kennedy has raised his profile. I can't think of many first term senators who've done a better job of making a splash in Washington as Kennedy's done. I mean, there have been ones who've done who've made a bigger splash, but Kennedy's made a pretty big splash up there, and he's going to be a if he runs against John Bel Edwards, he will be a formidable opponent.
And he also is raising money. I think he has over $3 million, so he's off to a flying start as well.
Yeah, he is. He will not need to spend a lot of money on name recognition. He will, he's got access to the press in ways that few potential opponents would, and so he's making the most of that. And Kennedy knows how to use the media about as well as anybody in Louisiana politics, and that's just that alone is worth several million dollars in advertising.
Nicholas asks if future candidates for major offices will be inclined to tweet since it's worked so well for Donald Trump.
Well, you know, it works well for Trump because he's the president, for one thing, and every word that the president says is policy, you know, is the policy of his or her administration. So it's just going to be natural that whatever the president says, and especially for Trump, who I think he's only done one or two, you know, full-blown press conferences since he's been president. There's not a lot of access to his thinking on a daily basis, and so the Twitter sort of becomes this insight into his mind that maybe wouldn't be as valuable to a president who is more accessible to the press. It's harder for you know, a governor or a senator or a mayor to make a splash with Twitter, just because what's on their mind is not nearly as consequential. So presidents are always going to have an easier time, I think, especially someone like Trump, who I think everybody knows he's the guy actually tapping out the tweet. When Obama did it, or when Hillary Clinton did it, or when George H.W. Bush, or whoever does it, any politician does it, you're not really sure that that's really their voice. You know that's Trump's voice.
Yeah, it's Trump's voice, and he goes places I'm sure advisors cringe, like a few weeks ago when he was criticizing Harvey Weinstein for sexual impropriety. Donald Trump is a person who has a record on that level as well that some feel is not all that great.
Yeah, that's right. And he did go after Weinstein, and he's gone after Bob Corker again, about five or six tweets really viciously attacking him this morning. It's kind of a sight to behold when he gets on a binge like that.
Marianne in Lafayette. Good morning, Marianne. You're on Talk Louisiana with Bob Mann.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Bob Mann. And
good
morning. I want to point out something, and that is that when Mr. Mann was speaking about how it's a little unusual for a senator like Kennedy to, shall we say, enter the Senate and from the get-go discuss, you know, the idea that he's trying to, you know, run for the top office in Louisiana, the governor. But, Mr. Mann, I'd like to point out that that is exactly what Barack Hussein Obama did when he got in the Senate from Illinois. From the get-go, he had his eye on the White House. And, frankly, I don't know what he did for the people of Illinois. And a lot of the people of Illinois don't know what he did for the people of Illinois.
All right. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, I mean, it's an accurate statement for sure. He was definitely looking at running for president the minute he arrived. I will say that there's a, I think, more of a natural progression from, you know, the House to the Senate to the presidency or to a president's cabinet, because they're all dealing with national issues in Washington. I mean, every member of the Senate wakes up every morning and sees a president looking back at him or her in the mirror. That's gone on from time immemorial. It's one thing to leave state politics, move to Washington, and immediately begin plotting to go back to Baton Rouge and run in state politics again. I mean, those are two different ponds, and I'm not saying there's anything improper about it. I'm just saying it's kind of head scratching, and it may work for him, and it wouldn't be the first time that a senator has run for governor and done it so successfully. That's happened a lot of times, and right. Almost happened several times here in Louisiana.
And I did want to ask you before we part about the Ken Burns documentary. You wrote a definitive book about Vietnam, A Grand Illusion. What do you think?
I haven't watched it. I didn't want to watch it live because I wasn't going to be able to watch every night of it, so I'm going to binge watch it at a later date. So I don't know. I've heard good things about it, but I have not watched it yet.
Well, your book is, I think, 16 years old, and many of the themes that are in the Burns documentary you touched upon. It was certainly a war that continues to divide America in many ways. Look at the remarks that John McCain and Donald Trump have made about each other.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing how it's that service in Vietnam is still a touchstone in American politics.
And John McCain, what was the comment he made yesterday about rich guys got out on bone spurs? I wonder who he said. He was not referring to President Trump.
I can't imagine who he would have been talking about. It's kind of head scratching who he could have meant.
Well, what was it? A questioner yesterday asked him if he were afraid of Donald Trump, and his response was to laugh.
And yeah, he laughed about 15 seconds.
He's
I don't think John McCain's afraid of anybody.
I don't think anything. No, he's a tough guy. But Bob Mann, it's always good to get your take on the world. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jim.
See you soon. And for Emily Gunn, I'm Jim Inkster. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. One of our guests will be Dr. Laura Cassidy, the wife of the senior U.S. Senator from Louisiana. Until then, thanks for listening and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.